Westwood One presents Two Chairs and a Microphone.
Checking 1, 2.
Here's your host, Paul Mercurio.
All right. Thanks for checking out the podcast, everybody. Got a really cool guest this week, somebody that I've been a big fan of for years, groundbreaking comedian, part of a comedy team. You're going to be really, really into this conversation. But before we get to that, thank you for putting comments on iTunes about the podcast. Please keep that up. If you go and hear something you like, say something nice about it and tell your friends. And I'll be doing stand-up April 27th to the 29th at Comics Comedy Club at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut. So if you're in the area, tri-state area up there, whatever, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Mass., Florida, come from Hawaii. It's Comics Comedy Club, Mohegan Sun, April 27th to the 29th. And as always, thanks for checking out the podcast. My guest is Tommy Chong of Cheech and Chong fame. Really cool conversation with him. And before we get to that, here's a little of my stand-up.
Can we all agree that we're not going to buy cases for our cell phones anymore? Because it's a scam. I bought one, I spent $30, and it's crap. And when I bought it, I said to the guy, why do I need a case? He goes, oh, something could happen to your phone. I go, well, you can drop it, break it, whack it. And I said, is it the phone the case? Isn't this thing that's in my hand right now, that's the case? Why am I buying a case for the case? It's a scam. You don't do that with anything else in life. You don't have a baby, and they're like, look, I know it's got skin, but you might want to laminate it. That's all I'm saying. Another $69.95, easy cleanup.
On with me today, someone that I've wanted to meet and talk to, and I've been a big fan of for years, and I don't want to make him feel old by saying that, but Tommy Chong is on. Nice to have you on the show of Cheech and Chong and Tommy Chong himself, the one and the only. How's it going, man?
Hey, it's great, man. And to make sure everybody knows that I'm not really literally on you. On the show.
I was trying.
I was literally on you.
I was trying to get you on my lap to like do the interview that way. But your people said that you don't do that anymore. You used to, but not anymore.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Well, thanks for being on, man. I really appreciate it. And you've got a great podcast yourself called Chong and Chong, and people should check that out on the Sideshow Network.
Yeah. In fact, don't listen to any other podcast but mine.
Wait. Well, except after this episode, don't listen to any other podcast.
No. Listen to this one, because if you don't listen to this one, you won't know about Chong and Chong. So you have to listen to this one.
Oh, man. Always a pitch, man. I like it. So you had this really interesting stuff I've learned about you. I thought I knew a lot about you, but there's stuff I didn't know. And I knew you were a musician, but I didn't know how accomplished you were. And for people out there who don't know it, and I want you to talk about this, you had a number 29 on the U.S. pop chart list hit song, Does Your Mama Know About Me? Because you, you were part of Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, signed with Motown Records. You were like a serious deal musician out of Canada. Talk about that and how that came about.
Well, we were the first non-black group. I won't say white because I'm half Chinese.
Right.
So we were the first non-white group to sign with Motown in 60, I think it was 66. I think we signed with them. What happened is that we were playing in an after-hours club in Vancouver, Canada, owned by my family. You know, it was a Chong-owned nightclub. Mm-hmm. And we got discovered by Diana Ross, of all people. Diana Ross and the Supremes came down to the club one night and saw us.
Wow.
Diana Ross was having a little thing with Barry at the time, and so she called Barry, and Barry Gordy flew out to from Detroit and listened to us, heard us, and signed us up. Wow. And then probably forgot about us.
Wait, why? What, because you were in Canada and not in Detroit or L.A. or New York and you needed to be?
Well, I think he just wanted some of Diana Ross, you know. And if he just went, if he had to sign us up, well, that was like part of the deal, you know.
anything to keep the blowjobs coming, right?
Yeah, exactly. So then we waited, you know, we were so happy, we celebrated and everything. And then we waited for, you know, a couple of days and a couple of weeks. And then Bobby Taylor, he's like from New York. He's old, hard, battle-hardened R&B singer. Right. He said, "Oh man, let's just go to Detroit." And so we gigged our way over to Detroit. We played in Seattle, then we played in Los Angeles, and then we flew from Los Angeles to Detroit and met with Berry Gordy and recorded the song. And then in the process of recording, after we had the hit, we were on the road and we met a little group that won a contest, and they were opening for us. We were opening for Jerry Butler. Mm-hmm. This unknown group had this little guy who could really sing and dance. They were called the Jackson Five.
Wow, really?
And so we discovered them, and Bobby Taylor again. He took the initiative. He said, "Come on, guys, you can stay at my house." But he had an apartment.
Yeah.
And so the Jackson Five stayed at Bobby's house or apartment for close to a month.
Wow.
And then Berry Gordy, heard him and signed him. And the little known fact is that I was the only non-white guy that the Jackson Five knew, Joe Jackson. And so they brought me the contract to look over for them.
Because you were the non-white guy in the group.
Yeah. I'm the only guy that looked like a lawyer, you know.
So was the dad traveling with them at the time? The oldest one had to be just a teenager, right?
Yeah, the oldest one was, Jackie was the tallest.
Yeah.
And the oldest. And Michael was about, Michael was about eight years old then.
Wow.
And and so Joe was traveling with them. And so when we got there, Joe was with them in Chicago. We played with him in Chicago. And then, then when he brought the contract to me, I said, well, they'd sign him up for 7 years. And I said, it'd be a good place to go to school for the boys, because Motown had a school at the time. For all their entertainers. And so that's where Michael really learned how to dance and sing and present himself.
Did you see the raw talent there at eight? Did you see?
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah. I mean, it was there. I mean, he sang My Girl, the Temptation song.
Yeah.
He sang it. He did a number on it.
And he sang it at that young age, very soulfully, and as though like he were an old soul in a way, right?
Yeah, well, he had that ear. He could hear everything. Bobby Taylor had the same talent. Mm-hmm. In fact, Bobby ended up producing their first album.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, that was the payback for bringing the Jackson Five. We got to work for Berry Gordy some more.
How did you come to be with Bobby Taylor? How did that come about? Because I know you were like you were in a band called Tight Shades. You were in a band called Four Niggers and a Chink, which
that's part of Bobby's. That was Bobby Taylor's group too.
Because you were doing okay in school, and you dropped out of school, and you're like, hey, musicians get chicks. This seems like a good deal. Like, how did music come into your life?
Well, music, actually, that's where pop came into my life, because I was struggling with school. I had quit school in grade 10. It was too hard. And and then when I became a roofer almost a year.
That is a hard job, man. That is.
Hey, that got my ass back in school, I'll tell you.
So you don't want to do that when you're high either. That's the one job you don't want to be stoned doing.
No. Except when you put your foot into the hot bucket, then painkillers is good. No, and then I went back to school and I managed to get grade 10, I got grade 11, and I was working on the last grade, and then I couldn't make it. Mm-hmm. No, I got high. Someone turned me on to pot.
In the 11th grade?
Yeah, in my 11th grade. And then this is like, I was always oldest in my class. So now I'm twice as old. I'm two semesters older than everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so then I smoked pot for the first time and listened to a Lenny Bruce record. And that did it. That was like, okay, I just want to be a blues musician, and I just want to get on the road with a band. That's all I want to do, play music.
What was it about Lenny Bruce? I know you, in reading about you, you had said that, you know, he was talking about pot and legalizing pot in the 60s. Was it that, or was there something in the...
It was the freedom that he had. He was talking about, you know, really taboo subjects. You know, one of his funniest bits was the governor of Orval Faubus, you know, the racist governor of Mississippi. He's talking about Lenny's having an imaginary conversation with the daughter. Mm-hmm. The daughter and Orville Faubus are talking. And she said, "Daddy, I met this beautiful Italian boy. His name is Harry Belafonte." Oh, he's Italian.
That was that ability to kind of say whatever you wanted to say. But you were still interested in music. That wasn't the bug that bit you to do comedy, right? You were just...
Oh, no, not at all. No. I just loved comedy. Mm. And the other connection to comedy was with Red Fox. Because when we were in Detroit struggling with Motown, you know, doing our first album, Red Fox came to the 20 Grand, the little club in Detroit. And I seen genius there. I seen Fox did 2 hours, man. And he took him up, the first hour he took him right up to the point you were laughing so hard you were hurting yourself. Mm-hmm. And then he took you down. He made people so disgusted they ran out of the club.
Got really blue or got controversial?
Got really blue. He just turned that. He took that crowd and he turned them, literally turned them against him.
Why do you think he would do something like that?
Because he had the power to do it. He's the only comedian I've ever seen do it on purpose.
Really? You
know? Like he lost him to the point that they were running out of the door, and Red Fox said, "Open the door for them." He went to the door. "Thanks for coming, y'all. You know, drive carefully now. Okay, now let's." And he went, walked back on stage, and brought the crowd right back up.
So
he had that ability.
You're a musician at the time, with no plans of being a comedian or doing comedy.
Yeah.
But there's clearly something about comedy that's grabbing you. What is it that's intrigued at this stage of your life? You're this is the 60s, and you're, I don't know, you're 20. I don't know how old.
My late 20s.
Okay, what is it that's grabbing you about comedy, do you think, at that point in your life? Because you're not thinking about doing comedy, but you obviously...
No. It was just, I mean, when I got into the blues, I got into jazz. In fact, the band that I quit school for had a sax player that was really a piano player. He went on to become the Dick Ken Cheney Experience in Chicago, and I played bass while he played his jazz piano. So I got a taste of jazz real early, and so I really became a jazz musician, not very good one, you know. Technically, but I understood the world, and jazz and comedy are exactly alike.
I think so too. Explain to me why you feel that way.
Well, because it's free form. You take a subject and then you play with it.
Right.
But you come back to the theme or the subject, you know, but you can take any subject and like any chord structure, and then you mess with it and you play with it. And then like you might play the fast song real slow or real slow song real fast.
Right.
And it's all done from the heart. And so and every jazz musician I ever met always had a joke. Always had their one joke that would make you cry so hard that snot would come out of your nose. You know, that kind of feel. And they always had the perfect timing. Like they that's who Red Fox would hang with. He would hang with musicians. because they were the best comedians. You know, they weren't another comedian waiting for everybody to shut up so he can do his bit.
Yeah.
They were guys that were riffing as they went along, you know. Yeah. And then the band itself, Bobby Taylor, is very funny. He's a very funny guy. He was between him and I, we come up with the name of the Fours in a It was a bet.
We said, did anybody sit around and go, hey, this might be a problem? Like, that is the most ballsy name I've ever heard in my life. Like, and you went out for a while, but then you had to change it to the four N's and the C's, right? Like,
yeah, well, what happened? We thought, oh, that's funny. So we owned the club at the time.
Yeah.
And what happened in Canada, in Vancouver, these club owners, they would buy the building and they would have nobody to run the club, you know, to make it successful, because it was very hard. And so then we got offered clubs all the time because we had a band. And so we got offered the first club, the After Hours Club, downstairs from a ballroom. Mm-hmm. And the ballroom had a history of not doing business, you know, losing business. The ballroom, which was called the Retinal Circus, once booked the Stones, Rolling Stones, and lost money.
What?
Yes.
Was this before 64? When would this be that they lost money on
this? This was in the late, it was in the 60s. It was before, it was before we got signed with Motown. So it had to be around, 60. Anyway, it was in the mid 60s.
Before they became the Stones that we know today. So
the Stones were, you know, they had that little hit. They had that, the initial hit.
Yeah.
And then touring, and they had lost, you know, they were going from, you know, from venue to venue to venue. And they happened to stop at this one. And they happened to come at the same time James Brown was playing. And Vancouver was and probably still is a bit historically a rhythm and blues town. Mm-hmm. And so so when the Stones went up against the James Brown, and James Brown's playing in the big arena, you know, and so... So everybody went to see James Brown, and a handful of people went to see the Stones. And James Brown's band came down to the club. Our club was the only place open after they finished their gig, and it was where they could, find chicks, you know.
Yeah.
And so James Brown's band came down, and we were playing on stage. There was about 12 of us on this little ass stage. And the club was packed. And I looked in the back and I could see the entrance, and I could see Keith Richards and Ronnie. Was it Ronnie Scott? Is that his name? Ronnie Woods in the back, waving at me, trying to get my attention so I'd get him in. But the club was so packed, I couldn't do anything. And my brother didn't know who the Stones were.
Jesus, that's gonna go on your gravestone. Like, couldn't get the Stones into a club. That's unbelievable. That's the greatest story ever.
They got turned away, man.
But how did you come? Did you come to know them just from them coming into town and playing that your club, your dad, your family's club? Is that how you got to know the Stones personally?
No. We didn't. I didn't meet the Stones until Cheech and I opened for them. The Nicaragua benefit that Mick had.
Oh, okay.
For his then wife or girlfriend. Mm-hmm. And they played at the Forum, and Lou Adler, who was our manager at the time, got us the gig to open for them. And so the Cheech and Chong opened for the Stones at that gig.
Oh.
And it was that was the first time we played in front of L.A., in front of 16,000 or 17,000 people.
Mm.
And that's when we found out that comedy works in the huge venues.
Yeah. Well, up to that point, you were doing, you know, like theaters, like 1,000, 2,000 seats.
Well, not even that. We were doing little folk clubs, like the Troubadour.
Right.
And little clubs all over the place. But we had a record out. And so when we went on and did our bit, I mean, the crowd just ate us up. And that was the only time that I'd met the Stones. And Keith, We never really hung together at all, you know. He liked a different brand of dope than I did.
Yeah, well, that's good though in a way, because then you don't end up poaching each other's stash. You know what I mean? You each got your own.
Well, we had the band Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. No, it was after that Four Niggers in a Chain. Mm. Oh, and let me tell you the end of that one.
Oh yeah.
So we got the sign up. Mm. Excuse me. We put the sign up, I think, on a Thursday.
Now, this is at the club in Vancouver.
Yeah, this is at the Retinal Circus, the club that failed
the Stones.
For the Stones, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we're downstairs in our club. We got the sign up. We ended up inheriting the big old marquee sign. And so we put the sign up, you know, four M's and a C, and that night, hardly anybody came. In fact, there was one. We had one customer earlier for the first set, and it was a black lady, and she's a wrestler, a professional wrestler, Lottie the Body. Her name was Lottie the Body. Lottie is sitting in there, and by herself. Mm-hmm. In the front seat, staring at the band. And then she starts yelling. She goes, "Well, I see the niggers, but which one's the chink?" And my dad, who was Chinese, was working the door. Right. And my dad, I don't think he even knew we put the sign up there, you know, because he was just kind of older and not really interested in much more than just looking after the door.
Yeah.
My dad walked over to her and he says, we can't have that kind of talk in here. And the body picked him up and body slammed my dad on the dance floor.
Oh my God, that's great.
And so I jumped off the stage. I put my guitar down. I jumped off the stage and I ran over and she grabbed me and body slammed my ass on the
two chinks get their ass kicked by a black woman. That's awesome.
That's right. It was karma. Instant karma. And then the band were rolling on the floor. They were laughing so hard at me. And finally, my brother, he subdued Lottie. I don't know how he did it, but he put her in a chokehold or something. But anyway, he calmed her down. And so we had to change the name. And then my brother said, "You got to change that name. You got to change that sign." We changed it to four N's and a C.
No, there you go.
No, we changed it to four colored guys and a Chinese lad.
Yep. There you go. You'd be fine in this day and age, in this politically correct day and age. That would be fine.
Oh, we it would be like Ferguson. There'd be riots, I think.
So your dad, was he a musician? Was it in the cards for you to be a musician because you had a parent that owned a music venue, and that were you musically inclined as a very young age? At a very young age, like where did?
No, I was actually cursed. It was almost a curse. I learned how to play guitar good enough to play with this fiddle player that lived across the field. We lived in the country, and so we lived in it's like a little squatter shack, you know. Mm-hmm. And across the field, you know, no electricity, no running water, you know, outdoor toilets, and across the field was this guy and this other fiddle player that was building his own house, and I became friends with him. I was 8 years old, about 8 years old when I started playing guitar. I was musical. I could. Right. Pick out a tune on an accordion. I started off with an accordion, a little accordion that my cousin owned. And I used to go to his room and play it all the whole visit that I was there. And finally, they just gave me the accordion. Here, you take it. He doesn't play it. And so that was my first instrument. And then I learned how to play a little guitar. I learned enough to play the backup, the fiddle player. And then I got good enough so that the fiddle player would wake me up. You know, I'd be sound asleep, and they'd wake me up. "Come on, you got a party to play," and we'd go play parties, and that's how I got into guitar.
Oh wow! And then, like, I think it was 68, right, that you started to get involved in comedy. But you had a topless improv troupe called City Works that you formed. And
well, I got fired from Motown. Motown, it's a movie.
You were supposed to get like work visas or something, and you screwed it up, and they fired. Tell that story.
No, what happened? Okay, now we're in Motown. You know, we didn't even think. Like I said, we gigged our way across America, but without any work permits or anything like that. You know, we that was just too much paperwork for us.
Right.
And so we just go across the border. You know, they hang you up forever. If you see you're just going for a visit, then they let you through.
Yeah.
And so we were in Detroit recording. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the band who we recruited from Canada, they decided to go home for Christmas. And so they did. And then they're coming back. They told the truth why they were there. And next thing we know, we get a visit from the immigration people, and they voluntarily departed us. We had to leave on our own. Oh, and okay. So we weren't arrested or anything, but we had to get out of Canada. And so then I told Barry Gordy, you know, my problem. And so Barry put his lawyers on it, and Barry was in the process of getting me and the bass player a green card.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, in the meantime, Bobby Taylor had been taken from us as Motown, you know, in their wisdom, put Bobby, he was producing the Jackson 5, and then he went on and did a solo album. Mm-hmm. And we were, the rest of the band was backing up Chris Clark, and she was singing, and she was this, another white girlfriend of Barry Gordy's.
Oh, geez.
And she was, but she had no idea what a green card meant, and she was kind of a tyrant in a way with the band. You know, she tried to be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so she told me, I told her that I had to leave to do the interview to get my green card. And she and she told me that if I left, that I would be fired. And I actually smiled, you know, because, you know, I was always the leader of the band. And so I never even dawned on me that anybody could fire me, you know.
Yeah.
And so I took the bass player and we went to Detroit. We had the meeting and it looked like we were getting our green card, and so then we were fine. I went to fly back to the gig, and then Motown told me, well, there's no ticket for you. There's a ticket for Wes, but there's no ticket for you. And I said, well, there must be a mistake, because I got my everything's back in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And so they got me a ticket, and they looked kind of embarrassed. And then when I got there, then I was told that I was really fired. And the rest of the band, they just turned their back on me. These are handpicked guys that I picked personally to be in the band. They wouldn't be there if it wasn't for me. Wow. And they never stood up for me. So after I got fired, and so I took my stuff and went back to Detroit, and then Barry Gordy called me, I think, the next day, and he said, oh, you're not fired. That was just a mistake. But I told Barry, I said, you know, I think I'll stay fired. I told him, I said, I want to be a Barry Gordy. I don't want to work for a Barry Gordy. I want to become a Barry Gordy. And he said, I can understand that. And so he gave me $5,000 severance. And I went to Los Angeles. I had a girlfriend at the time, and she was with me, and we had a baby. And I was married at the time, too. So it wasn't the best time in the world to quit a job.
Yeah, well, you were keeping
but
busy.
But I did. And
you had a very active penis, huh? You were keeping busy.
I had seen the committee a couple of times, and I'd seen Second City in Chicago.
Right.
And so I had this idea of turning the strip club into an improvisational comedy
club. Now, this is a strip club that your brother's running called the Shanghai
Junk. Yeah.
And then
they had it was the first strip club in Vancouver, too. That was my idea too. When we got offered this other club, now we got two, three actually, right, for a while there. And then it was just a dinner club, and I said, well, the topless thing was just coming in, and so we put a topless club in Vancouver. But it was doing good, but it was doing great, you know. Mm-hmm. And like all topless clubs, you know, like the people would come and get drunk and not even watch the show. They'd just be around naked chicks.
Yeah.
And so so when I saw that, then I wrote a show for the girls and the entertainers that we had, you know, where they would the first bit was called the pajama party. And they had played the club and they were at the girls' house and they're all going to get into their pajamas. So they got out of their street clothes and they put on their jammies, right, which is the sexiest thing that they'd ever seen in that club before. And then the girls would say, Jeannie's coming over. And Taps Harris was the MC. And Taps was this one-time great tap dancer. Mm-hmm. He was at the end of his career. So they ended up pretending that Taps, show us the number that you do at the club. You know, kind of a cheesy show, but it worked. And Taps did his number. And it was the first time that the audience in the club had really seen Taps do his dance. And he was good. So they clapped, and they clapped so hard they made him do an encore. Wow. And so that night, Taps quit because he was working too hard.
So
the doorman was a really good friend of mine, very funny guy. And I said to Dave, I says, do you want to be the MC? And he said, well, I'll do it if you do it.
This is Dave Gray.
Yeah, he called me out. He called me out on it. And so Dave and I started doing comedy and doing bits that I remembered from the committee in the Second City, you know. We just, you know, then we would get, like all good improv groups, we would retire, intermission. We'd have an intermission. We'd do a show, then we'd take an intermission, take suggestions from the audience.
Right.
And we'd write down the suggestions, and we'd go back, and then we'd work on them. And then after a half hour, we'd come back on stage, and there would be a new audience. So the audience that asked for their suggestions were gone, and so we did a new show, and it was great. And we had a straight man, and we started packing the club. Mm-hmm. The club became packed, mm-hmm, but they weren't drinkers; they were like wine sippers.
Yeah.
And so we started losing money, but we had different, we had a mime artist, we had a classical guitarist, we had Dave and I were the hippies, and we had a straight man. And then when the straight man got found out that his wife found out where he was working, she made him quit. And then that's when we hired Cheech, and then Cheech was like the understudy.
How did you even know him, and like what was the connection to him that even entertained the idea of bringing him in? How did you guys know him?
There was a Russian connection. There was the Russian guy that he was writing for, Ihor Tordak, I think his mm-hmm. name. Anyway, he was telling me about this guy. He's, I got a guy that'd be perfect for your show. He's really funny. Mm-hmm. You have to meet him. Come on out to my place and meet him. He lived out in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And so I drove out there with my now wife, Shelby, and our daughter, Precious. Mm-hmm. And we met, we went into the little magazine area, you know, where they're working on the magazine. And there he was, a little clean-shaven little guy. He looked like a little Mooney. He looked like a little religious guy because he had real short hair. And he looked like Johnny Mathis, actually.
Oh, really? For people who don't know, Cheech is from L.A., but was in Canada at that time, basically, I think, avoiding the draft, right? He wanted to he didn't want to go to Vietnam and was and found himself in Vancouver. That's how that connection came about.
Yeah, well, he was you know, they started drafting. Well, he was Mexican, and so he was at the first of the list. You know, he was trying to get out because of the college thing, but they was like, "I'm sorry, Mr. Marin.
Yeah, you know,
you're coming with us." And so he became a landed immigrant in Canada. Mm-hmm. He did everything right. He had the papers and everything. And he studied pottery. He was he became a potter's assistant in Calgary.
Oh wow! So then he's part of this as three man, you, Dave, and he, and he's some more of the straight men. And then how does your
the girls too? We have four and girls.
And then how do the two of you break away from that and then become the partners that you become for all those years?
Well, what happened is that the more successful we became, the broker the club became, because we lost all those heavy drinkers.
Because they were coming to really watch the show, huh?
Yeah, and we weren't charging enough at the door to make it worthwhile. You know, the entrance fee never changed. We weren't really good at running clubs. We had no clue of. You know, the way you run a club like that, you don't pay anybody. And we were only paying everybody like $5 a night. That's all everybody got. Mm. You know, the girls got a little more. Mm. But the actors, you know, we never paid anybody. But we weren't making money, the kind of money that we were making with the strip joint. And so my brother actually fired us. and so the group it was really good, but it disintegrated. Then the girls went back dancing, and then Dave he became a roadie for a band. Mm. And the mime artist became a jeweler, and the classical guitarist became a member of his own band, and he was the one that wrote the hit Cheech and Chong song, you know, that Eric Alice Boy, you know, that Eric My Eye.
Yeah, well, it's funny because
Cheech and I, we were the only ones that showed up at rehearsal. It was just Cheech and Chong, and so we put a band together because he's a pretty decent singer.
Yeah.
And so we put a band together, and I was back on stage as a band, but I had that acting bug, you know?
Yeah.
And so the first gig we played, we never played any music. We had the band there.
Just doing jokes and stuff and screwing.
We did a whole 45-minute set, and just Cheech and I. And then at the end of the set, you know, the bass player says, so when's our next gig, boss? And that was Tom Lavender, the Powder Blues band.
And are you pretty heavy in the pot at this point on your personal life? And is that starting to become part of the act? Or like, what were you doing at that point as a team? What kind of material was it? Was it stuff musically based comedy, or what was it?
Well, it was stoner comedy right from the get go, because part of the clubs. Oh, and then during that time, we lost the After Hours Club that was our cash cow. Oh, that's one of the problems. And then, so we started the club in the back room of where we did our improv. And so for a while there, we had there were two clubs in that one, in the Shanghai Junk. But we aimed it toward hippies, and hippies don't have money.
Right.
They have bodies, and they have good dope. And so so we had the best dope. We had the best hash. We had the best acid. And the night I met Cheech, we were so stoned on acid that we could hardly see the stage, but we performed like incredible. I mean, that's really what made.
Wait. Do you think in your mind you performed incredibly well, or is it just in your mind? And when, if you looked at it objectively, it wasn't very good, or was it really a good night?
It was really good. It was really good. Because what happens when you perform high and you watch it high, you get all the nuances that you miss. You become so in the moment that no matter what you do in that moment, you're not trying to think of another moment. You're just in that moment. Mm-hmm. If you're playing a character, you are that character, you know, until the very
end. There's a sort of a purity to the performance because you're really literally going moment to moment, which is ideally where you want to be. Going back to your reference to jazz, I think that's the case with jazz and great improvisational jazz and great improvisational comedy or great stand-up comedy is you do want to be moment to moment.
Yeah, and the thing is, you can do you be on a riff and look up and not have any applause because there's nobody in the room. Everybody left, you know? and that's with comedy, too, you know? I mean, I've done sets where I've been brilliant, but there's been no one there. And it was one of the reasons I was brilliant because I never had anybody that I had to cater to, you know, except myself.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's sort of like auditioning for the industry. And when they're in the back of the room and you're aware of it, maybe you get a little tighter than if it's a set that doesn't mean anything. And it's 20 people in the basement somewhere and you don't have that monkey on your back of feeling like you got to prove something. There is that difference that can happen.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what acid and that's what cocaine did for all the comedians, you know, except me. You know, cocaine worked for me when I wrote a song. When I wrote that Does Your Mama Know About Me, it was my first time doing cocaine.
Right.
And so it really touched whatever it was. But the second time, I never wrote anything. And the third time, I started, you know, destroying things. And so...
bouncing off the wall. So hash, pot, acid were good creative juices for you, creative sources of inspiration for you to, as a comedian to write comedy and perform comedy?
Yeah. Yeah, it still is.
Yeah.
It still is. Because I'll be in a nice, like at a nice high, not you know, really stoned out high, but just a couple of one hits. And all of a sudden, things start really coming into focus.
Right.
And then I can, and I try to remember, you know, I'll write down some of those ideas, you know, and then I'll never look at them again.
until you get high or stoned, then you pick them up and go, this is brilliant.
Jesus. Yeah. So well, the thing is, everything is brilliant if you don't judge it. You know, that's why I go by the biblical judge not, you know.
But you have to judge it. But you have to judge a little bit because you have to have some standard of something not being completely shit either. Like not everything is good, right? Like you do have to have some base level of like, okay, this is a really terrible joke, and I'm not going to say it. Or
oh no, that's what I mean about Red Fox. That's what I'm talking about. What Red Fox? It'd be like an artist using every color on his palette except black.
Right.
Because black's very, you know, I don't want to go there, you know. No, you use everything. You use everything. And that's what Kennison would do. You know, Kennison would take you to the brink and then push you over the brink.
Yeah.
And then just by his force of his nature, a lot of times people ran out of Kennison's set. You know, they couldn't take it.
Yeah.
Other times, you know, if you could take it, oh, man, you saw brilliance. No, you made that mountain harder to climb, but when you get to the top, it was like, wow, that was worth it. That's a good workout.
So as you're now kind of formulating this relationship and partnership with Cheech, I know you talked about Lenny Bruce early on. Are there other comedic influences that are roughly what year is this now? And are there other comedic influences that are really kind of blowing you away and having an impact on you at that stage of your career?
Well, 69 was the year that we got together. It was in 1969.
Right.
And then we went up to Vancouver. I mean, from Vancouver, then we played two clubs in Vancouver. Well, yeah, two clubs. There was the Forum, the big club, mm-hmm. the Battle of Bands, which we won. without playing a note. And then we played a little blues club where down right next to our after hours club. Mm-hmm. And then I told Cheech, I said, we got to go to LA. And so Cheech, we snuck back into LA. One of the first Mexicans to sneak into
go the other way
into the US from Canada.
Well, what was it about, why did you know you had to go to L.A.? Because it was L.A. and that's the center of the entertainment business? Or
that's
what?
That's it. Out there in New York, and New York's too tough. L.A., I had connections. You know, my first wife was living there with my kids. Mm-hmm. And so we had a place to stay for a while anyway, until she kicked me out. She married a musician, not a comedian. When I became a comedian, it was like, okay, you're out of here.
Yeah, yeah. The musician's one step, a couple steps above comedian.
So, a musician is like being married to a waiter, you know. it's not the best job, but it's a job.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
comedian? Oh, forget it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the guy. That's the guy that's not even allowed in the restaurant.
Hey, listen, I even had girls that I'd met when I was a musician.
Yeah.
And then they wouldn't even talk to me because when I became a comedian, they wouldn't even talk to me.
How was it getting? So the goal at 16 or 17 was, hey, I can get laid if I'm a musician. Now you're a comedian. And it's tough to get chicks, so that's working against one of your big goals, right?
No. I had too many girls.
Oh, you did.
So I wasn't looking. You know, I had a girlfriend with a baby and a wife with two babies.
Yeah.
So I really wasn't looking for any more.
Didn't that stress you out? That didn't stress you out to have like one woman with two kids, another woman with another kid. Like, how are you keeping it all straight and not having that affect your work? Or did it?
I loved them both, and they're both incredible, loving people.
Yeah.
And they loved me back. The one that loved the musician, she was very sad to see the musician go.
Mm.
But she was not about to be catering to a comedian. Yeah. And the comedian, the wife that I still have, and she's a comedian now herself. Mm-hmm. She was the one that kind of, she inspired me, and actually helped me to encourage me to move into the, you know. And she was the one that when I told her that I got fired from the band, she was in the motel waiting for me, and she's, oh, that's good, honey. They suck. Come to bed.
That's great.
That was her take on it, because she knew that I had more to offer than to be a backup guitar player. You know?
Well, what happened to the Barry Gordy dream that, you know, you said to Barry Gordy, I don't want to work for Barry Gordy. I want to be Barry Gordy. And now
I became a Barry Gordy. I became independent. In fact, I became bigger. Oh, I didn't tell you this.
But when I hear someone say, I want to be a Barry Gordy, I think they want to be behind the scenes producing. You're going down the path now of being in front of the camera, in front of the audience as a live performer and a film star, as a comedian.
Yeah.
You wanted to be more entrepreneurial is what you probably meant, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to work for somebody. I am.
Yes.
What I was saying is that I don't want to be a Barry Gordy. I am a Barry Gordy.
Yeah, you want to be the brand. I was a lawyer and a banker on Wall Street and left to be a comedian because I wanted to be my own brand. And
that's exactly it. That's exactly it. And that's what happened with me, you know, because like even starting the clubs, when I got the clubs handed to me, basically, I turned them over to people that knew how to run them, like my brother. He was a perfect club owner. And so a lot of people thought it was his club, which was fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same as the money. Had I stuck with the clubs, I would have been a very wealthy guy, you know, because I would have bought buildings and blah, 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 you know, that whole route. But instead, I saw a better future becoming, you know, say a comedian, like a comedy team. Yeah. You know, when I saw that Cheech and I could command, the audience, you know, rock and roll audiences, then I saw dollar signs, you know, because we were the only comedian. We played a club in Manhattan Beach owned by the Smothers Brothers that the Smothers Brothers would not play.
Why? Too tough?
It was a beer joint. It was so rowdy that the Smothers Brothers never played there. They owned it, but they never played there. In fact, they told their people, comedy would never work there. You know, it's too crazy. And their people told them, well, Cheech and Chong come every Monday night, and they pack the joint, and people love them. And so that's the kind of power that we had, because I could play guitar. And if the crowd ever got real rowdy, I'd just make, you know, turn the crowd, turn up the amp a bit, you know, and play a rowdy song.
Were you doing song parodies as part of the act, or would you do music as a way to, like you just said, keep the crowd in control? Like, how did the music become, how was the music part of the act at that point?
Well, actually, it was comedically. I played Blind Melon Chitlin. You know, he's an old blues guy, which I copied. I got the idea from the committee. They used to do a bit called Blind Melon something. But I saw T-Bone Walker, the original T-Bone Walker, play a gig where he was so drunk, he just mumbled. And
everybody probably thought it was some brilliant.
They give him a standing ovation.
That's great.
And I saw that, and so I just took that act. I took that T-Bone Walker bit, and so I would play harmonica on that one. So what happened with the guitar? After a while, Cheech and I, we never carried the guitar with us after the beer joints. But we would play, songs that Cheech knew, and I knew, just loud rock and roll songs. We'd make up some stuff.
Why did you stop carrying the guitars and eliminate the music? What prompted that?
We got more into not props, but hats and different costumes. You know, we've become different. We've been almost like a quick change. You know, we put on. I'd become an old guy, and Cheech would become a Latino. It was when Cheech started doing Pedro, the Latino guy.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and then everything shifted. Up until then, we were like two guys. Mm. But then we got to L.A., and Cheech started doing that lowrider. That put us in a different category. And
Explain that. What do you mean we were two guys, and then...
Two comedians. We could have been anybody, from anywhere. You know, we weren't ethnically identified at all, in the act at all.
And
we're more like, I was a long-haired hippie, and then Cheech became a long-haired hippie. Mm-hmm. We're like two hippies. Mm-hmm. But when we played a club in the valley, in San Fernando Valley, called Irma Cafe. And it was a dance club. And the guy had seen us around town, and so he loved us. And so he wanted us to entertain the people that came there to dance, which was kind of a mistake because they were dancers. They weren't there to see comedy.
Yeah.
And so we went on stage, and we did okay, but not great. And so we got off stage, and then I said to Cheech, I said, come on, man, you're from here. There must be a character that we can... They can identify with, And Cheech says, yeah, there's one, but I hate to do it. And I said, why? He said, well, it's kind of, detrimental to the Latino people. And I said, well, that's our name of our job, man. we do. We are detrimental. And so the next show, Cheech told me what the character was a bit. And then I remembered an old... black comedy bit that I'd seen many times, in my travels. And so I showed him, it was a car scene. And so we added the car, the low rider, and then I show up as a hitchhiker, a junkie, like a pill freak, hitching a ride with this Latino guy.
Yeah.
And that became Up in Smoke, the movie.
Yeah, that's a huge movie. That's fascinating. So it's all born out of that club. That's what people don't understand who aren't, the clubs are the farm team, if you will, to hone these bits. I had Stone Cold Steve Austin, the professional wrestler, on my podcast, and there's an eerie parallel between, you wouldn't think it, professional wrestlers and us as comedians, because he said when he started out, he'd go from little podunk town to podunk town, these little venues, unknown wrestler, and he'd try different characters to see what was connecting with the audience until he hit on a character that really worked. And it was exactly the same thing that comedians do. You talked about at one point you guys were basically two hippies that weren't really defined, and then you kind of figured this out and you became Pedro and the stoner guy, and that's how this stuff happens. It's trial and error. It's working. It's working. It's a little bit of luck, and then you define yourself. That brings that sort of differentiates you from everybody else in the pack.
Yeah, well, it identifies you. You know, you become okay. That's like with Cheech. In fact, we became a part of the dictionary now. You know, that's like a Cheech and Chong bit.
Right.
Oh, that's a Cheech and Chong thing, you know.
Were you having trouble? Did you ever have trouble getting booked on TV shows because the core of your act was, you know, promoting weed, and, you know, it's not, weed isn't doesn't have as negative a connotation, I think, these days it might.
Oh, yeah. We still never done the Saturday Night Live. You know, we've never done that, never been invited. They did a parody on us just recently, but Lauren Michaels, you know, he hates Cheech and Chong, as far as I know, you know, because, you know, that's the kind of television that would not have us on, you know. And we influenced Belushi and Aykroyd during their doper days, you know, big time, because we met Belushi, you know, when he was with the Lemmings. And he told us stories about how the Second City hated us so much because we went out, we did albums, you know, before anybody, and we used the Second City technique. And so they jumped right into the studio. But those guys were too more theatrical than they were, you know, like down-home ex-musicians, you know. Right. So they never got the nitty-gritty part. But Belushi... Belushi loved he loved Cheech and Chong. When we were shooting movies, he would show up on the set. He'd come hang with us. He was a big Cheech and Chong fan.
Was he off camera? Was he quiet? Was he razor sharp off camera? Like, what was he like? Would he have this spark that would just turn on when the camera was on? Like, what was his demeanor?
Belushi and Aykroyd both were like musicians, you know. They're like, you know, in fact, they put a band together. Remember the
Blue Oh, Brothers? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, so both of them, you know, Dan Aykroyd, you know, he was is a great harp player, you know, and Belushi was a better than normal average singer. So Belushi fronted a band, you know. Oh no, they dug us right from the get-go. We had that musician connection.
Mm. What is it about comedy and music? I mean, I know a lot of musicians that as you just mentioned, end up moving toward comedy, or a fair number. And then there's a lot of comedians that can play drums or guitar and whatever. Like, what is it about those two art? You don't see that with anything else. You don't meet like a painter and a sculptor who do this. Who, you know what I mean?
There's one that does everything, like Martin Mull. You know, he's a painter and he plays.
No, I know. But what I mean is, like, there's something about comedy and music. You see, you meet a lot of people that have that in their DNA and have done both, and have done maybe one more than the other. And you don't see that a lot with a lot of other art forms. Like, you don't meet a lot of people who are both sculptors and painters, or both like. Writers and paint, like, what is it about comedy and music that seems to relate to each other for some reason?
It's we're dealing with space, you know, like silence.
Yeah,
you know, the music would not exist if you don't have silence in between the notes.
Right.
And see, it's a silence that separates one note from another note. And it's the same thing as talking, you know. There's a time, you just can't talk. There's a time where you have to pause, you have to wait. And so it's that timing, you know. And as comedians, we learn how to you know, milk a joke just by waiting for people to understand what you're saying, and then get the humor. And so it's being able to have that sense of timing, and that comes with being, you know, every musician, they have to be in the moment more than any other job there is. Comedians, we can be in the moment, and then we can drift. We can do anything we want. But when you're playing in a band, and you know, you have to be, you can't be ahead of the pitcher. You got to be, or behind. You got to be right there. And that's what comedy is. It's all about timing.
Yeah. And so you guys are getting, you're as big as you get, and you've done Up in Smoke, and your team, and I worked as not as a performer, but as a team, as writing partners with some people, and it can be challenging when you work in a partnership. It's like a marriage. There can be tension, there can be friction. And did you guys just reach a point where, like, you were kind of, you know, just getting on each other's nerves too much? You travel, you're spending too much time together, arguing too much? Like, what caused you guys to stop working for so long?
It was the opposite. It was the opposite. Mm. Cheech and I, as long as we were connected, we were okay. You know, even we didn't have to be in the same room or in the same, even in the same country. Mm. But there was a connection. And when that connection got broken, it was, I think, well, it was me. I had moved to France.
Oh.
And I did we did two movies over there. We did Still Smoking, mm-hmm. and which was supposed to be a concert movie. Mm-hmm. And we did The Corsican Brothers. Mm-hmm. But what broke us up really was that Lou Adler... We fell out with Lou Adler after Up in Smoke. Mm-hmm. And because basically Cheech and I wrote and directed mm-hmm. most of the movie. Lou Adler helped direct a lot of the you know, Stadenko bits and that. But I'm a natural director, you know. Mm-hmm. I had, and then I ended up directing all the other movies. And that kind of put a thing in between Cheech and I. Because mm-hmm. once you become the director, then your word, it's a final word. And Cheech, up until then, you know, Cheech and I, we shared everything.
By the way, for those of you who may not know who Lou Adler is, if you watch a Lakers game and you see Jack Nicholson, there's always a white-haired gentleman sitting,
it's like by him chilling,
and sitting right next to him or near him, and that's Lou Adler. And yeah. Lou Adler is a famous record producer, manager, director. As you know, he owned the Roxy Theater in West Hollywood, and so you're in France. You had moved there, and that started to cause the rift or the breakup, or
what happened? We got separated.
Mm-hmm.
See, up until then, we would be separated. Cheech would go on vacation, and then I would stay and write the movie, you know, whatever movie we're working on. And then he'd come back, and we'd shoot the movie, and then he would go his way, and I'd go my way. And then, I kept doing that. But then there came a point where he wanted to be, you know, more a part of the writing part, you know, because I took over more and more and more, you know. And then it got to the point, the Corsican Brothers, Cheech says, well, I don't want to have dope in this one. You know, that's like fading out. Cause Cheech was hanging with other actors and the Eagles and people like that. And they weren't as dope based as everybody else was. And so he sort of wanted to get away from it. And I said, you know, everything was, to me, was a challenge, you know. Okay, do a movie without dope? Yeah, I can do that. And we did. We did the Corsican Brothers without any dope in it.
Right.
But that wasn't the answer. Mm. It was that, and then Cheech and his wife were breaking up. In fact, they broke up during the Corsican Brothers. Mm. And so he had that change of life going on. Mm. And then he got offered to do a movie without me. Mm. That really was the you know, I joke about it now, but you know, like I didn't know we'd broken up until I went and seen the last Cheech and Chong movie and I wasn't in it.
Yeah, that had to be hard. And so you guys go your separate ways and you're pursuing different interests, him acting, you acting, and so forth. And then Did you not speak at all for a while before? I know you eventually did get back together through the help, I think, of your wife and your son, but which is an interesting story in and of itself. How was that separation, that estrangement?
Well, what happened when we broke up? Like Cheech came to me and said, you know, I'm doing another movie. I'm doing this Born in East L.A. Without me. And I had already been pissed off because he did the song without me. Until then, you know, I would write the lyrics. I would write the most of the song. But Cheech would sing the lead. That was the deal, you know. It was like Eerie My Eye. Cheech was the singer, you know.
Right.
And Basketball Jones and all those great Cheech and Chong songs, you know, that was the deal. I would write it and he would be the singer. And that's what we did with Bobby Taylor, you know, Does Your Mama Know About Me? That was written for Bobby Taylor to sing, you know. So when it came to Born in East L.A., he called me up. He said, I wrote a song. I want you to be in it. And it was like, what do you mean you want me to be in it, you know? And he had a little part for me where I play a cop, you know, and it was like an insult, you know, come on, you know, whenever I directed, you were the star. Now, if you're directing, you would think you would make me the star, you know, but I found out that, you know, that quality that I have is very special and not everybody has it. And unfortunately, or fortunately, Cheech never had it. And Cheech always needed a Don Johnson or a Kevin Costner or someone, you know, that he could play second fiddle to. You know?
Right.
And that's what happened, you know, with his career. So
was he aspiring? when he broke up, you guys broke up, do you think he was aspiring to be not the second fiddle or not in a partnership, but be his... the leading guy himself or the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He wanted to have his voice heard. Mm-hmm. You know? He didn't want to just be known as the funny Latino, you know.
Yeah.
That's what he's stuck with, you know.
Well, that's what this business does to you, whether you like it or not. Once you pick that, you know, you're kind of stuck with it, whether like it or not. That does happen, you know.
Well, that's what you want to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when you're in this kind of, you're on your own doing your thing, and then did you have to kind of rediscover yourself as an artist at this point because you were very defined by this partnership with Cheech?
You know, I was watching the news last night, and Rodney King Beating came on. And it's an anniversary for me. It was the first time that I went on stage. Was the night after Rodney King got beat.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to do bits about Rodney King's beating.
Wow.
And I did. I said, do you notice how cops, you know, the mothers of, as long as you're on television, you know, it doesn't matter why you're on television, mothers are very proud. And the mothers of the cops going, well, that's my son. He was the one that was beating him.
How cool is that guy, man? I got a contact high just talking to him, and we were on different coasts when we talked, but really awesome to hear how he got started and relationship with Cheech and all of the excursions that he's had in his career. So anyway, thanks for checking out the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. And April 27th to the 29th, Comics Comedy Club, Mohegan Sun. Hope you guys can make it. That's in Connecticut. Great, great venue. And thank you for the comments, and keep those up too on iTunes, and see you guys next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.